Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Josh Gondelman's fellow comedians call him the nicest man in comedy. He's just released his third stand-up album. It showcases Josh's kind, gentle sense of humor and includes a number of jokes about his pug, Busy. The album's called Dancing on a Weeknight. What does the title mean?
It's like fun, but it's not outrageous in any way. I think it's just very like, it's kind of like a mostly wholesome good time that, like, you know, maybe it leads into other things, maybe it doesn't, but it's the idea of just like dancing on a weeknight is just like slightly outside of what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, a little outside one's comfort zone. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're taking a bit of a risk, a small risk, but a risk nonetheless.
Right.
Yeah.
But all that, really what that means is like, The follow-up is like sleepy on a work day.
Yeah, maybe that'll be the next album. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How has your comedic voice developed over the years that you've been doing stand-up?
I think it's gotten a little closer to how I see the world. And I think I've gotten better able to be more like myself and more like the ways I can be funny off stage while I'm on stage. Like And I'm also doing less saying stuff because it's funny and gets a laugh, and more saying stuff that's like, oh, I would like to talk about this. Like, this is an idea or an experience I have, and I wonder if I can put that through some kind of filter and turn it into comedy, rather than like, I have this thought, I said it, people laugh at it, so it stays in the hour.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah. So how would you describe your comedic worldview?
I would say it is like optimistic with an acknowledgement that things are bad. So, like, I think the thesis, if there was one, of my comedy is like, yikes, this is pretty rough, but, like, I think we can do better.
Yeah.
Again, it's not we're going to have a wild night out tonight. It's not I'm saying what we're all thinking. It's just like, hey, let's give it our best, guys.
Yeah.
Which is, like, I think not a ton of people come at comedy from the from the point of view of like a slightly frazzled substitute teacher, I guess is what I sound like.
Yeah, that's right. Because you taught what was it? You taught preschool 4-year-olds?
I did. I taught 4-year-olds for a number of years.
Yeah. So how did teaching 4-year-olds how has that influenced, or I guess the question more is, has it influenced your approach to stand up in any way?
I think when you teach kids, there's like a very gentle level of sarcasm and like darkness that you can get away with when you talk to them that flies slightly over their heads. And I think that's like a fun place to be. Like, I used to teach, and I would always get tasked with sitting with the like 3- and 4-year-old girls that were just throwing unimpeachable, unassailable tantrums and just sitting with them and just going, I know it's so hard. I know life is really complicated sometimes, and it's just like a thing that is both true and sarcasm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love the fact that you used unimpeachable there in association with the tantrums.
Yeah, just like a tantrum that is like an imperturbable frenzy that's just like, it's like trying to soothe a tornado.
Yeah, that's a great image, yeah. I especially enjoyed the bits on the new album where you talk about your dog, Busy. Can you tell me a bit about Busy?
Yeah, so Busy is she's about to turn 12.
Oh,
she's
wow.
A 12-year-old, almost 12-year-old pug. If you can't picture a pug from the name of the breed, it's kind of like a furry little cloud that's too fat to fly. If that doesn't do it for you, she looks like a loaf of white bread with a face smushed onto the front slice and a butt smushed onto the back slice. And if you've never hung out with a pug before, it's kind of like if that loaf of bread came some of the way to life. That's her vibe. She's got the energy level of most yogurt, if that.
She has like the pug traits of always wanting to kind of be right up in your business, but she's not. I think a lot of pugs are like kind of persistent, like kissers and lickers, and Busy is not. Mm. She has like a very pretty woman, no kissing attitude. And so she's just like a very funny, she's like having a little grumpy roommate around. And when she gets, when there's stuff that she wants from you, like if she wants treats and you don't want to give her treats, or if you haven't noticed that she wants treats yet, she will jump like right up in front of your face, like sit on your lap and then sneeze in your face. And it's like, intentional. And it is like very funny and sometimes very annoying, but she's just like the cutest little cloud of a of a dog.
Yeah. She sounds like a great dog. Yeah. There's a great moment on the album where you deal with a heckler, and it's very, very effective the way you deal with that heckler. How do you handle hecklers in general?
Oh my gosh. So it was really back and forth with whether to include that moment, because it's not that common to get heckled. And this was kind of the most common kind of heckle that you get, is just someone who thinks that they have something to add.
A law firm? I like mine better. I'll tell you what, if you have any other alternate punchlines over the course of the evening, just write them down on a little piece of paper, walk to the Gowanus Canal, and throw the paper into it. But I'm glad you're here.
I didn't want to include it my response got a big laugh.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to put forth or propound the notion that, like, hecklers help the show or, like, lead to better comedy, because I would rather not do that. Ultimately, I think Dominic Del Bene, who is the guy, the head of the label Blonde Medicine that I'm putting out the album with, really found it, kind of convinced me. He thought it was, like, a fun, charming, like, live moment.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did, because it is a great moment. Do you have a favorite bit or a favorite joke on the new album that you're particularly proud of?
Oh, that's a great question. I really like talking about Maris in an affectionate, admiring way. Mm-hmm. It's like, because that's how I feel about her, and it's very fun as a challenge to create comedy out of that. And so I feel very proud of being able to achieve that.
Before we were married, back when we were engaged, people would ask my then fiance, now wife, all the time, right in front of me, if she was going to take my last name, which is a little presumptuous and it's a little sexist, right? Because no one ever asked me if I was going to give it to her, huh? If I was just going to let her embrace the poetry that is Gondelman into her life every day forever.
I mean, there are people in very loving marriages that make a lot of great comedy out of conflict, but it's just like, that's not, to me, the central experience of being married. And it's still a fairly new marriage. We've only been married about 2 years next month, or exactly 2 years next month. But I don't think it will get into, like, the old ball and chain.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, like, to speak about being married like that does a disservice to specifically to my wife, but it's also like, why would I do that when I can, like, scratch a little harder and get to the, like, how do I really feel about this? Like, what do I want to say? And, like, it's fun to express different kinds of feelings and different kinds of, like, foibles that are based in my own brain rather than, like, she said this and I said that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure, definitely. The Village Voice, in one piece and in a story about you, they described you as a high-functioning neurotic. What does that mean to you? First of all, do you agree with that? Do you agree with that description?
It's a very sweet and very fun way to describe me. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm that neurotic. Drew Grant at The Observer years ago, when I co-wrote a book with my friend Joe Berkowitz, and Drew described me in, I think, a piece about that as a pathological sweetheart. And I feel like that is something that's always stuck in my mind, where it's not that I'm neurotic and functioning in spite of it. It's that, like, my specific pathology has me locked into, like, unfailing politeness even when there is no reason to be polite.
Yeah.
And kind of a unflagging cheeriness even when there's no reason to be cheerful.
Yeah, exactly. That, well said. Yeah. And you're frequently described as the nicest man in comedy as well.
That's very kind, and it's very nice to have that reputation, and I try to be nice. I think there are other very nice people, but I think I might not be the nicest, but I'm definitely very friendly, and I think friendly reads as nice when, like, kind of quiet and supportive otherwise doesn't outwardly play as nice all the time, especially when someone's act is a little grittier than mine. And I think, like, because my act is also very cheerful and pleasant, that I reap the benefits of that. People conflate that with who I am off stage, which is, like, very close to the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. You and your friend Jack Moore came up with what is one of the most brilliant Twitter accounts ever back around 2012, and I'm not using hyperbole here. It's called Modern Seinfeld. Can you tell me about Modern Seinfeld?
Sure. So we haven't done it in a while, but the premise was, like, what would be little plot threads if Seinfeld were still on the air? And just because so much of it was based in, like, little etiquette customs and kind of, like, technological snafus, like answering machine messages.
Yeah.
And there was just so much of it that felt like if you lived through that time, it still plays. I had tweeted a couple things about Modern Seinfeld plot lines just from my own account. And Jack was like, you know, this could really be a thing. And so he staked out the handle at Seinfeld Today. And then we just kind of wrote that for a while. And it was, again, very flattering that people liked it.
Do you have a few favorite Modern Seinfeld tweets?
I think my favorite one was Elaine is hooking up with a neighbor in her building. And then when she breaks it off, he makes his Wi-Fi network name an insult about her so that everyone in the building can see it.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah.
Yeah, like Elaine is a jerk or something and then yeah. Won't change it.
A couple of my favorites are the one about Kramer renting out his apartment every night on Airbnb and living in the hallway. And Kramer says, I'm making cash hand over fist, Jerry. And Jerry says, you're homeless. That's a great one too, yeah. You managed to parlay your Twitter account into a comedy career. How did you do that?
So I'd already been doing stand-up for a number of years by the time – a number of years. Of course, there's no way to do stand-up for a non-number of years.
Yeah.
But I'd already been doing stand-up for, I guess, 7-ish years seriously, maybe 8,
yeah.
By the time that happened. So when the Twitter account exploded kind of basically overnight, we got these opportunities. People wanted to talk to us about things. They wanted to – hear pitches for stuff. And I was, like, slightly unprepared. I, like, didn't have a lot of scripts ready to go, hey, staff me on this show. Here's my writing sample.
Mm-hmm.
But it did start getting me in the mix for late-night TV jobs. I was able to submit writing packets for those that were topical and that didn't rely on, like, okay, I have a feature-length film that I've worked on for years, and here it is now that I have these opportunities. So I did after the Modern Seinfeld Twitter kind of blew up, I applied to writing jobs basically for a year thanks to the like a little bit of industry attention and validation that came from that. And I did a little work for Billy on the Street in the summer of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got hired at the beginning of 2014 to do the digital social stuff for Last Week Tonight with John Oliver as that show was launching. And I did that for a year and then was moved over mostly to write for the show, the second season. And I wrote there for 4 years. So I was there for half a decade, which is like truly wild to me. I never thought that could happen. I truly, when I started doing stand-up, did not ever really think like, oh, I'm going to get to work at a show that I'm really proud of with people that are really great and for such a sustained period of time. It just like didn't feel, you know, because I would watch like The Daily Show in high school and college and think like, man, what a cool thing that is. And then I got to work in that field.
Why did you choose to leave Last Week Tonight to go work with Desus and Merrill?
It was just a really exciting opportunity that came up to work on a new show that was launching with people that I think are so funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt very different in terms of what the show would be like and what the and their comedic voice. And so I was really excited to move and have kind of different responsibilities at a different show that I also felt really psyched about. And so I don't think I would have, you know, I wasn't like clawing at the walls to leave. I would have been very happy coming back for another season.
Mm-hmm.
But right as the season was ending, I got asked to interview for this show. And it just seemed like a really fun next thing to work on. And I'm I'm really enjoying it, and the guys are so funny, and it's just, again, going from like one super over the moon dream job to another one, and which has been a great privilege.
Look, Josh, how you feeling about your team this year?
Don't matter.
I feel good. When did they win that championship on your hat?
Oh, Josh is talking spicy.
Damn, Josh, how you gonna get unemployed the same year the Yankees win? Crazy. It's crazy.
As you alluded to, last week, Tonight follows kind of a more traditional late-night model, while Desus and Mero is more unconventional, more free-form, so to speak. Did you have to develop a different comedic voice and kind of comedic timing to work on this show?
It is very different. It's mostly, like, structurally different, where instead of writing as many super precise jokes, it's a lot about writing incredibly clear, clean copy that leads Desus and Mero into the kind of improvisation they're doing, and then it's writing a lot more sketches, pitching more like silly ideas to do in the field, man on the street stuff. And that was one of the things that I think was appealing to me, was that I wasn't going to be moving and writing the same kind of show in a different voice, but it would be like fully flexing different muscles, or like developing different muscles. And I'm very I'm like really enjoying learning how to build up those skills too.
Josh Gondelman is a stand-up comedian. He's also a writer and producer for Desus and Mero on Showtime. His latest album is called Dancing on a Weeknight. You can find out more about Josh on our website, wpr.org/beta.
That's what my grandmother's wish was, is that we would keep the music alive always. And so as a young kid, that's what I was told. When we're all gone, you have to make sure to keep the music alive.
Up next, Carlene Carter honors her country music heritage, June Carter Cash, and the Carter family. I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.